Hello, everyone. This is Brian McClanahan again, and we're going to pick up where we left off with the last presentation, discussing Mr. Lincoln's war and some of the, of course, political ramifications of that war, the way that war is going to impact not only the South but also the North. And so, what we're going to do in this part of this presentation is get into more of that stuff a little bit. We're going to talk about the Northern home front and the Southern home front. And of course, we'll also wrap up the end of the war militarily and talk about some of the important battles and some of the things that were going on there. But we left off talking about the Emancipation Proclamation and how the Emancipation Proclamation was essentially a political move by Abraham Lincoln to keep Great Britain out of the war. Most importantly, to keep them from breaking the blockade, which was preventing the South from selling their cotton and also importing industrial goods or other things that they needed to maintain this war effort. We know the North has industrial production, the North has banking institutions, the North has everything they need to prosecute this war. They have a much larger army, much better navy. The South, of course, is having to play catch-up, and it's really remarkable the South is able to hang in there for 4 years. We know also that in the Eastern Theater, Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson are the better generals, and so they're able to keep the army in the field, which is what Lee understood needed to happen in order to make this war a success for the Confederacy. We will talk about the Western Theater, which is going to be a little different than the Eastern Theater, at least after the death of Albert Sidney Johnson, and we'll get into that in this half of the presentation. So, let's pick up with the Emancipation Proclamation. Okay, Lincoln issues the thing September of 1862. Of course, a political move. He frees the slaves only in the South, not in any areas controlled by the Union Army. In fact, again, it's not the Emancipation Proclamation that ended slavery in the North. It was the 13th Amendment, which was not ratified until December of 1865, 8 months after the war was over. So there's this misconception in the U.S. today that the Emancipation Proclamation freed slaves and was a great turning point in the history of America. Well, not really. I mean, it wasn't until the 13th Amendment that we see that. And of course, today you see a number of black churches, for example, celebrating the Emancipation Proclamation, when in fact they should be celebrating the 13th Amendment, which actually did what Lincoln said the Emancipation Proclamation would do. So, in that way, if you look at the war as you know, the ultimate end of the war is freeing slaves, well, that's a good thing. Of course, the question is, could that have been done a different way? Did we have to suffer a million casualties practically to do it? And I think that everywhere else in the world it had ended peacefully, except here in the United States. You know, that's a question that really no one can answer, because no one can say how long it would have taken or what would have happened. But we do know through history and as examples, it probably didn't need a million casualties to end slavery. Now, once Lincoln issues this Emancipation Proclamation, there are some real problems in the North. Number one, Lincoln, at the beginning of the war, had said this is a war to save the Union. Now, of course, the question is what Union, but he said this is a war to save the Union. So you have many men in the North signing up to save the Union. Once he issues the Emancipation Proclamation, well, that changes things, because apparently ending slavery now has become a war aim. And so what happens is you have mass desertions in the Union Army. There are a number of soldiers who just say, forget it, I'm not fighting to free any slaves. And so Lincoln has to make up for this, and of course you'll start getting a draft. They'll start really putting the pressure on immigrants as they hop off the boats to come in here and fight for the Union. You know, you get three meals a day and $300, and you get to go wear the blue uniform. Thanks for coming to America, Patty. Now go fight the South. So I mean, that was the idea. They've got to make up for a number of these volunteers getting out of the war after 1862. The Democrats also gained seats in the House of Representatives. So Lincoln is facing a political problem. Of course, he called this the fire in the rear, and his response to this political problem is going to be rather interesting. Of course, he started this at the beginning of the war, so did the other Republicans, not just Lincoln himself, but the other Republicans. In fact, one Democrat called Lincoln and the Republicans reptiles because of what they were doing here. I mean, these people were vicious in the North. So, you know, what's interesting about, again, this situation, again, most Northerners were fighting to save the Union. They were fighting for patriotism. They were fighting for the Founding Fathers. The same can be said in the South. I mean, if you look at, you know, what they fought for in the South, it wasn't to perpetuate the institution of slavery. In fact, only 25% of Southern families owned slaves. And if you take it actually down to the actual slave owners themselves, you're talking maybe 5 to 10% of the Southern population. own slaves. So, I mean, you're not talking about a large percentage of the population that owns slaves. And if you read the letters from these guys and things they were saying, again, it's the same thing. They're fighting for the principles of 1776. They're fighting for independence, just as the founding fathers did. They're fighting for patriotism, for their section, for hearth and home. That was often said, you know, if the Yankees would just get out of the South, we'd stop fighting them. They invaded our states. So they're fighting for hearth and home, for their families. I mean, that's a very powerful draw. So, you know, there was a great book written about this by James McPherson. And McPherson is no lover of the South at all. But it's entitled, you know, What They Fought For. And the idea behind the book is that, you know, Northerners were not really fighting to end slavery, and Southerners are not really fighting to perpetuate slavery. So if you take that into account, then the war becomes completely different. This book did receive a lot of attention, but I think generally it's overlooked now in the historical profession because it doesn't fit in with the paradigm that you have these self-righteous Northerners and evil Southerners out there, evil Southerners fighting to perpetuate slavery, these self-righteous Northerners fighting to end slavery. It just doesn't fit. So, again, this is a very important book. I recommend you read it. And it goes into detail the things that I'm talking about here. In fact, Robert E. Lee said this in 1861 to his men. He said, "Keep steadily in the view of the great principles for which you contend. The safety of your homes and the lives of all you hold dear depend on your courage and exertions. Let each man resolve to be victorious, and that the right of self-government, liberty, and peace shall find him a defender." So the South, in his mind, was fighting for self-government, liberty, and peace. Nowhere in that phrase is "we're fighting to perpetuate slavery." It was self-government, the right of self-government. Democratically elected conventions withdrew their states from the Union. This was not, again, done by a dictator. The people of these states decided that they no longer wanted to be part of this federal union in the North. And so it's the same thing that the founding fathers were doing in 1776. You can't say otherwise. There's nothing different about it here. Liberty, the liberty of their people. And of course, peace, fighting for peace. All the South wanted to do is be left alone. All they wanted was independence. If the North had stopped fighting them, the South would have stopped fighting. The South didn't invade the North initially. The North invaded the South. So this is again why Southerners often called this war the War of Northern Aggression, because they saw the North as aggressive here. Now, let's talk about this North for a second. The self-righteous North, apparently. This North that is completely against slavery. Well, I think in closer look, you're not going to find that. In fact, when we talked about the 1850s, we talked about confinement. And that's really what the North was aiming at throughout the 1850s, the 40s, and into the 1860s. It was confinement of slavery to the southern states. They didn't want blacks in any other part of the North. In fact, there were several states that had laws prohibiting blacks from even living there. Of course, there's fear of competition for wages and jobs. Remember, go back to free soil, free labor, free men. Again, this is the North of slavery. This is what was going on. So when you say this Emancipation Proclamation freed slaves, well, it only freed slaves in the South, and a number of men weren't fighting to free slaves, and so they just left the army. Again, this is why, because there wasn't a tremendous amount of friendly sentiment in the North to free blacks or slaves. And it wasn't just blacks. It was also Chinese immigrants. You had tremendous anti-Chinese sentiment in places like California. So you had that situation. Chinese immigrants faced terrible, terrible conditions in California. In fact, they are the only people that had to pay a certain tax in California at one time. So the idea was to tax the Chinese out of California. And then, of course, you had the Know Nothing or American Party. And, of course, it wasn't just blacks and Chinese. It was also Irish immigrants, German immigrants, particularly Catholics. So you had a tremendous amount of xenophobia in the North during the period leading up to the war. And a lot of these American Party members then became part of the Republican Party. So this carried that over. So these people weren't, you know, wholly self-righteous people. They had their own issues when it came to respect for other peoples and other religions and things of that nature. Remember, the South had actually two Jewish members in the cabinet. Of course, one Jewish member in the Confederate Senate. They had recognition of the five civilized tribes in Oklahoma, and they had a non-voting seat in the Confederate Congress. So the South was much more tolerant, if you want to say that, than the North ever was. There were, of course, Southerners who complained about the fact there were Jews in the cabinet, but that was few and far between. It wasn't a big push to have this anti-Semitism. And, there wasn't there was a situation in the South, again, where you had a more diverse people, so to speak, running the show in the South. And in fact, when you look at what happens when the North starts passing draft laws, you start seeing lynchings and acts of violence against blacks, particularly in New York City when there's a draft riot there. So blacks, free blacks in the North were not well accepted. Of course, we'll talk about the myth of the black soldier in a few minutes and how that worked out. But for the most part, what you're seeing in the North is oftentimes what people would call today extreme racism. And of course, that term racism was not even kicked around until the 20th century. But you would have Northerners who were not so receptive to the idea of freedom, emancipation, other peoples living in the North. In fact, General Grant, U.S. Grant, said this at one point during the war. He said, "If I thought this war was to abolish slavery, I would resign my commission and offer my sword to the other side." So here's the guy that's going to be the hero of Appomattox, the hero of the Union Army that wins the war for the Union, saying that slavery wasn't really why he got involved in the first place. And that was just the sentiment of a number of Northerners. So that wasn't anything odd. Now, let's talk about this Northern home front. So we know there's a tremendous amount of xenophobia. We know that Northerners really want to contain slavery in the South. In fact, ending slavery wasn't really an aim. It was to save the Union. So if we look at this Northern home front, we know that only about 40% of Northerners actually fought in the war. And many of these men were immigrants fresh off the boat. In fact, if you read any of the short stories written by Ambrose Bierce, there's a great short story where he's a prisoner of war, and he's the only guy of the Union prisoners that can speak English. And that wasn't odd. I mean, there were a number of Germans, Scandinavians, people who had just come to the United States, immigrants, who were paid as a substitute, Polish people, paid as a substitute to go fight in the South. You had rich Northerners who could afford to do it. It was called a commutation or substitute fee. It could be $300. It could be $500. You actually had societies that were set up to raise money to make sure that people who didn't want to fight in the war could get out of it. So there was tremendous opposition to just even getting involved in this thing in the first place. A lot of Northerners didn't want this war. And I think that's a common misconception, that there was this rally around the war in the North, that for some reason every Northerner wanted to fight the South. Well, I think if you look at the political atmosphere in the North, it wasn't that way. There was a tremendous opposition to this war. In fact, again, that's the American tradition. There was tremendous opposition to the War of 1812, tremendous opposition to the war with Mexico, tremendous opposition to the American war between the states. You can even look at the American War for Independence. There are Americans that didn't want to be part of that either. And the only war that you can say in the United States history where you had this great rally around the flag, and that was only after the war began, was World War II. Before that point, you had a tremendous opposition even getting into World War II. So Americans generally don't want to be involved in wars, for good reason. And in this particular case, once the Emancipation Proclamation is issued, there are Northerners just trying to leave in droves to get out of this war. But even before that, there were Northerners that said, what's the point of this war? Why are we trying to coerce a people? They're just essentially doing what our ancestors did in 1776. I mean, why shed blood over this? Of course, there's going to be a draft instituted in the North, and there are going to be riots, not just in New York, but in other states like Wisconsin. There are some major opposition to this draft. No one wants to serve willingly or unwillingly, or I should say a lot of people don't want to serve willingly or unwillingly in this war. And so they're going to try to get out of it and do everything they can to get out of it, including if they've got money to pay to get out of it. Just hire an immigrant, put him in the blue uniform, let him fight the South. Now, this Northern opposition, again, Lincoln calls the fire in the rear. And it's important to talk about this for a minute or two. You had several members of Congress who were opposed to this war. And it's interesting what happens to them. The most famous case being Clement Vallandigham, who is arrested and actually sent south during the war for opposition to the Lincoln administration. Now, the theory is that he was trying to lead the Midwest out of the Union. There's no conclusive proof of that. And you actually had this fear of something called the Knights of the Golden Circle, which nobody can actually prove existed. It was kind of this organization that was designed to undermine the Republican Party and perhaps lead the Midwest out of the Union, maybe help the South. there's no real conclusive evidence this thing really ever existed. But Van Landingham was making some pretty damning speeches about Abraham Lincoln, and they had enough. So they arrested him, essentially charged him with treason in so many ways, and then said, you have to leave. So that was just one case. There were other cases, though. There was a senator from Indiana named Jesse Bright. And Jesse Bright was actually kicked out of the Senate because before the war even began, he wrote a letter to Jefferson Davis and addressed Jefferson Davis as President of the Confederacy. Well, that's the title that Jefferson Davis was claiming. So because he wrote a letter addressing Jefferson Davis as President of the Confederacy, this thing, of course, is stolen and then brought to Congress. They won't even sit this guy. And then, of course, he's eventually expelled from the Senate. In the Senate itself, you had a situation where the Senate will eventually declare that they are going to require an ironclad oath of allegiance if you're going to sit in the Senate. Well, there's a senator from Delaware named James A. Byard, the younger. He'll take the oath but then resign because he doesn't think that this is right and justified. You know, this guy had been in the Senate since the 1850s, and now you're saying you need an ironclad oath? And that was just the tip of the iceberg. As many as 13,000 Northern civilians were arrested during this war, perhaps more, for opposition to the Lincoln administration and the Republican Party. I mean, that just boggles the imagination. It only is exceeded by World War I. But 13,000 people, more actually. This is just, you know, we're able to say, hey, this is real political opposition. And a lot of these people were thrown in prison. Now remember, Lincoln has suspended habeas corpus. So these people can be arrested and not charged with anything and kept in prison indefinitely. I mean, this is tyranny. And there were a number of people that this happened to, prominent people. For example, I mentioned James A. Byard. His son, Thomas Francis Byard, who later became Secretary of State, was arrested for a time and held because of suspected Southern sympathy during this war. So this thing reached from the lowest citizen who might say something like, hurrah for Jefferson Davis, well, that guy could be arrested and thrown in prison, all the way up to people who were prominent members of the government. I mean, this is a witch hunt. And the Northern cabinet, you know, people like Edwin Stanton, just reveled in this stuff. I mean, this guy really was vindictive. Here's a guy that when the Northern Army moves through Southern areas, they'll actually take ministers from Southern churches and replace them with Northern ministers because they're trying to preach a message that the North is righteous and that you all need to be good Northerners and good Union citizens. So this is the kind of stuff that's going on. It's a terrible, terrible political climate in the North. And people are afraid. Byard, again, I'll mention Byard. His letters were being intercepted by the post office, opened and read, because they're looking for information that could lead to his expulsion from the Senate or perhaps arrest. I mean, think about that. The post office is now getting involved, and you had Montgomery Blair as postmaster general. This guy's he's the guy that initially called for, going and provisioning Fort Sumter. He wanted this war. He's the guy that's, you know, saying, hey, go do this stuff. I mean, go out there and read letters and intercept this stuff and make sure we find all these treasonous people in the North. This is terrible. That's not a free society. And the North was not a free society. And to ensure that the North is going to win elections, and we'll talk about this in 64, there's a tremendous amount of voter fraud going on that has to do with the Union Army and some intimidation tactics. So again, we'll talk about that with the 64 election, but this is a terrible, terrible climate to be in. It also must be noted that when these people were arrested and sent to prisoner of war camps, that's where they went. They went to places like Fort Delaware and Fort Lafayette and Camp Douglas. Camp Douglas in Chicago, they declared a martial law, the Union Army did, and arrested a number of Northern civilians and put them in prison there. In fact, women were put in this dungeon that they had underneath one of the main buildings in the camp. This is horrible conditions. These prisons were terrible. At Fort Delaware, prisoners were required to drink mosquito-infested water, you know, with the larvae in it. I mean, that's what they had. Disease was rampant in these places. I mean, these were just cesspools. The terrible fact about it is that the North could have prevented this stuff. Northerners had plenty of food to eat. This was willful mistreatment coming from the top down. Lincoln was aware of what was going on. His director of these prisoner of war camps was aware of what was going on. They were doing it on purpose. In the South, of course, you often hear about Andersonville and some of the terrible conditions there, but Southerners had no better. I mean, Southerners didn't have anything to eat, so they weren't going to feed Northern prisoners of war. But in Northern prisoner of war camps, again, Camp Douglas, some people were freezing to death. They didn't have blankets or coats, and that, again, was willful mistreatment. When one of the commandants of that particular prison decided he was going to get some coats, he was fired from his position during a very cold winter. So, I mean, this is the kind of stuff that's going on in the North. Fort Delaware, again, it was on this little place called Pea Patch Island. It was horrible. Disease was rampant through the fort. Dead bodies were just stacked outside as people perished at this prisoner of war camp. And it wasn't just Confederate POWs. These were Northern civilians who were arrested. They were sent to places like this. So when you look at this stuff, and I know there's been a recent book written about this and how it really wasn't so bad. It was called Andersonville's of the North. And no, this is all blown out of proportion. I don't think you can say that. This individual is just trying to justify some of the treatment of these prisoners and saying it really wasn't that bad. It was all cleaned up and everything was good and hunky-dory by the end of the war. Well, again, not necessarily. Some of these camps were just closed down, and they stopped reporting how many people were actually dying. Now, the black soldier myth. I mentioned this just a minute ago. There's this myth perpetuated by movies like Glory and even James McPherson, I mentioned earlier himself, that black soldiers swung the tide of the war in favor of the North, and that's why the North won the war. Well, black soldiers, of course, were heavily persecuted in the North. They weren't paid the same. They were only hired to do menial jobs. They really didn't have much combat impact until near the end of the war. And even the end, that combat impact was minimal. They weren't that successful in terms of troops. So there's this myth, again, that these people swung the tide of the war, and it's just not true. And again, because of the bad treatment of these soldiers, I mean, you can look at Northerners and say, well, these guys were, you know, extremely racist. They were. In fact, when the Union Army moved through areas in the South, they would often, of course, allow these black Southerners to become soldiers, but they were in charge of digging ditches and fortifications and building latrines. And a lot of the black former slaves in the South were resisting this stuff, particularly in the low country of South Carolina, where that's not the type of work they were used to. They were almost forced into it, just like slaves. So, the treatment of black Northerners and black Southerners by the Union Army was nothing to be celebrating. This was not a good situation for these people. And again, their impact on the ultimate success of the North in the war was very minimal. Now, let's turn this over to the South. So the North, a lot of opposition. 40% of Northerners are fighting in the war. There's all this opposition in the North. In the South, you could say practically the exact opposite. 75% of white Southerners fought in this war. 75% of white Southern males, I should say, fought in this war. I mean, 25% didn't. And out of that 25%, most of those people were supporting the cause anyways. There was some opposition to the war in the South, particularly in places like North Alabama and some of the hilly parts of the South. But for the most part, Southerners respectfully joined the cause and did so for patriotic reasons, for independence, liberty, peace, these type of things, self-government, just like Robert E. Lee said. In fact, there were about 90,000 black Southerners who also served on the Confederate Army in some capacity. Now, most of these people didn't fight. In fact, the vast majority didn't fight, but they were teamsters, cooks, this type of thing. And, when we look at the Battle of Gettysburg, for example, the South invades the North, and you had a number of course, black Confederates with this Confederate Army. They could have stayed in Pennsylvania, but they all went back to the South with the Army. In fact, it's reported, you can read this stuff. People were talking about black Confederates with badges and ribbons and these type of things. So they were as much a part of the Southern Army, maybe not necessarily in terms of combat forces, but definitely a part of the Southern Army. And you can find here and there sporadically mentioned black Confederates who actually did take up arms. But there was no policy of that. In fact, it wasn't until the very end of the war that Jefferson Davis allowed this to happen. And there were times, there were Southerners, of course, who wanted to raise black regiments, but they were typically turned down. So, there's kind of this two ways of looking at this. There's been this revitalization of scholarship on this issue, and maybe some tendency to overemphasize this, but there were black Confederates. It's also important to note that when you talk about slavery in the South, it wasn't just white Southerners who owned slaves. There were black Southern slaveholders, and some of the scholarship that's been done on this would point out that this was not just a benevolent thing to buy members of your family. These people were actually slave owners, and they had plantations, and they had some of them were doing horrible things like slave breeding. But that was the aim, for commercial gain rather than just for profit, rather than just to help their family members out. So slavery was a much more complex institution in the South than maybe you're told in junior high school and high school. Now, there was tremendous support for the South, for the cause in the South. Contrary to what some leftist historians would like to tell you, people like Drew Gilpin Faust, she wrote a very famous little book entitled The Creation of Confederate Nationalism, that is fabricated out of thin air. And Southern, you know, the Southern identity was just not really there, but it was. And, you know, if you look at this great book by Gary Gallagher called The Confederate War, and he goes into this. I mean, these Southerners really supported this cause through horrible, horrible conditions. By the end of the war, and I'll give you an example from the Battle of Columbus, people were placing, before this battle, this is the last major battle of the war, and it was a week after Lee had already surrendered his army, but nobody knew about that. They were placing as much Confederate money as they could in the place of church for offerings. You know, they were trying to say, here, we're supporting this thing joyfully. And here we are, we're already way into the war, and it looks like it's lost, and they're still giving to the cause. Soldiers are still fighting for the cause. So when you look at this and you say, well, these Southerners really didn't support this stuff. I mean, these people were facing property destruction, loss of life, plunder, starvation, rape in some cases. So, I mean, as the Union Army moved through, this is a horrible, horrible situation with these Southerners, and they continue to support it. And I think that's something that's in stark contrast to the North, where that just wasn't the case. If they had to go through these deprivations, I don't think Northerners would have been so willing to do it. Let's talk about the military aspect of the war and kind of wrap this up a little bit. The war really was lost for the Confederacy in the West. And you have a number of major battles here, but the two that I want to talk about between 61 and 62, first and foremost, is the Battle of Shiloh. This really is a turning point for the Confederacy in the West because it's a loss for the Confederacy, but more importantly, it's not just the loss of the battle. It's the loss of Albert Sidney Johnston, who was actually killed in battle, perhaps on accident by his own men. Johnston is killed, and he was, in many ways, thought of as the best general that the Confederacy had, maybe even better than Robert E. Lee. So when he's out of action in the West, the North is able just to move through and win victory after victory in the West. Really, the South doesn't win many major battles in the West, really any, to be honest with you. And so that's really where the turn of the tide happens. You know, as the Union moves through and cuts off of Mississippi, for example, and cuts out Tennessee, the war really looks very bleak for the South at that point. It's also in 1862 that you have the Battle of New Orleans. And this, of course, is the Battle of Mobile Bay and then the Battle of New Orleans. These are major naval engagements. And when the North takes New Orleans and Mobile, it really cuts off, in so many ways, the Gulf of Mexico to the South. Now, the South could still use Columbus, Georgia as a naval hub and still get down the Chattahoochee River, but the North had blockaded the Gulf of Mexico. So once the Gulf is cut and the Mississippi is cut, it's not going to be a good situation for the South. And, of course, the thing that came out of the Battle of New Orleans, the most important part of it, was the occupation by the Union Army and an order that was made that essentially made every woman in New Orleans a prostitute. I mean, so they were fair game for Union soldiers if they supported the Confederacy. If these women supported the Confederacy, that's how they were viewed. And this was, you know, terrible, terrible situation for Southern women. And it was, you know, vilified not only in the South but also in the North. I mean, you know, to denounced as some horrible, you know, horrible law, and it was. But this is the kind of stuff that, again, the Southern civilians are going through, and they continue to support the war. At this point, the North starts to look at a total war strategy. They're not only going to go after the Southern army, they're going to go after the Southern infrastructure and Southern civilians. And that's really one of the reasons why the North is able to knock out the South. I mean, they take out factories and farms, everything they can, and they really will do a number on the Southern economy. Now, the turning point of the war really is 1863, and there are three major battles in 1863. One is the Battle of Chancellorsville. This is actually a Confederate victory. In fact, maybe Lee and Jackson's greatest victory because they're so vastly outnumbered, but they just thrash the Union Army. But the important thing about it is that Stonewall Jackson will be killed in this particular battle. He's actually shot by his own men scouting a position. It's not being shot that kills him. He actually loses an arm. But it's the pneumonia that takes place after that. So now Jackson's out of combat. He's gone. He's dead. And so now Lee has lost his best tactical commander and his right arm, really. He really doesn't have anybody else that he can rely on like Jackson for strategy and tactics as this war continues. And that's going to play a factor in the Battle of Gettysburg, which also takes place in 1863. Lee has decided to invade the North again. And this is going to culminate the Battle of Gettysburg in July of 1863. Really, in so many ways, coupled with the Battle of Vicksburg, which is about the same time, will turn the tide of the war for the North. Lee is checked in his invasion of the North. The battle really was, you know, anyone's game on the second day. And perhaps if James Longstreet had acted a little more aggressively on the second day, the Confederacy could have won the Battle of Gettysburg. But they don't win the battle. Of course, Lee is not captured here. He could have been captured. If the Union had followed up, Lee could have been captured, but Lee is able to escape back into the South, and so the war will continue. So it was a loss, but not a loss like you would think it was a loss. Also, the Battle of Vicksburg. Grant is able to take Vicksburg in July of 1863, July 4th, in fact, 1863, which cuts off the Mississippi to the Confederacy. So now things look really bad for the Confederacy. Lee is now going to go on a defensive position, trying to protect Richmond. The Confederacy basically is lost in the West. And so 1864 is just a year in which the South is trying to maintain itself. Now, they continue to win battles. This is what's called the Overland Campaign around Richmond. In fact, this is when Grant is going to earn the nickname the Butcher. He's been transferred from the West to the East, and now he's fighting Lee. And what he's going to do is just keep throwing man after man at southern, well-defended southern positions. They've now figured out they can dig trenches and hold off against these superior numbers. And you have a number of major victories for the Confederacy here, but they keep losing men. And Grant knows he can get more men. Lee knows he can't. So eventually what happens is this war of attrition will wear down Lee, and he's going to have to surrender in 1865. It's also, again, this point in 1864 that the North is really going to use their total war tactics. In 1864, you have the Atlanta campaign with William Tecumseh Sherman, where he makes a famous statement, war is hell. Of course, he calls the South an alien people who deserve to be punished, I mean, severely. So what you have is a 60-mile-wide swath of destruction through Georgia where everything is forfeit. Property, people, you know, anything you can think of, plunder, this all takes place. In fact, it was often said after the war that if you wanted to find southern china, southern dresses, southern fine, you know, silverware, you go to the North because that's where it all was located. These people were stealing like crazy. And of course, then Sherman's going to move through after he takes out Atlanta, moves into Savannah, and then, of course, goes north into Columbia, South Carolina, where he'll actually sack and burn that city. It wasn't the only cities that were burned, though. Columbus, Georgia was sacked and burned. This is part of this total war strategy. As the Union Army moves through, they burn everything they can that would be useful to the Confederate Army. It's also in 1863-64 that you will have a 500-day siege of Charleston, really for no reason. The North just starts bombarding the tar out of the city because it was Charleston. And so the people there are suffering tremendously. You have terrible losses in the Shenandoah Valley as Philip Sheridan starts burning through the Shenandoah Valley in retribution for their support for the Confederacy. This is a horrible situation for Southern civilians. Things got really bad in 1864. Plus, you have a number of major battles for the South. They tried to hang on in the West. For example, the Battle of Nashville in Tennessee, just terrible Confederate losses. I mean, they're charging Union positions that are well defended, and it's just carnage. So the South is really desperate here in 1864 to try to maintain itself, and the end was coming. Now, Lincoln didn't know at the beginning of 1864 if this is going to happen. I mean, 1863, he's got a number of important victories, but the South was still hanging on. So he didn't think in 1864 he's going to win re-election. In fact, it looked like he wasn't. The Copperheads in the North were making a lot of headway. You had a very popular candidate in George McClellan for president. Here's a guy that was, you know, a war hero in their position of, you know, peace at all costs. Is going to resonate in the North because the casualty numbers are mounting. But what happens is after the Battle of Atlanta and after some of the things that go on in the South, victory is assured for the Union. So at that point, Lincoln is not going to lose. In fact, he wins with 55% of the popular vote and a crushing majority in the Electoral College. But I mentioned perhaps there was some voter fraud here. The Union Army was actually sent into several areas in the North to ensure that the elections were free and fair. So people were intimidated. They were required to take an oath of allegiance before they could vote. Some cases they had to pass under sabers to go cast their ballot. If they saw they were voting for Democrats, they were often pulled aside and said, do you really want to do that? Ballot boxes were stuffed. Union soldiers could vote two and three times, or maybe they were sent into an area where they could vote where the election might be in doubt. So there was a tremendous amount of voter fraud in the North to swing this election towards the Republican Party. It didn't always work. But there's an effort being made there. So you can say, again, that this was just a resounding support of Abraham Lincoln. In fact, if the South had been part of this election, Lincoln wouldn't have won again. So, you know, the fact is, you know, there's a lot of misconception about this 64 election. Lincoln was not that popular even in the North in 1864 when he wins re-election. Now, the end of the war comes in 1865. Lee will surrender to Grant at Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia, but the fighting will continue until May of 1865 in the West. The last major battle of the East was fought in Columbus, Georgia, 1 week after Lee surrenders, and of course Columbus, Georgia was burned at that point as well. The last surrender of a Confederate of Confederate forces actually takes place in December of 1865. You know, 8 months really after the war is over, there was a, it's called the CSS Shenandoah, a naval ship, and it didn't know the war was over, and it's still out there sacking Union shipping until they figure out, hey, the war's over, and so they surrender. Lincoln, of course, will be assassinated in April of 1865, and that, of course, is going to set the stage for Reconstruction, which we'll get into in the next couple of presentations. But we must emphasize here that, there were close to 1 million casualties again in this war. And the question is, was this necessary? Was it a necessary war? And, you know, again, at the beginning of this presentation, I talked about, and even with secession, you know, Lincoln could have stopped this war. He could have saved the Union. There were only 7 states out of the Union when he became president. And perhaps if he had supported some of the compromise measures, 1 million men didn't need to be killed or wounded in this war. But that's what's going to happen. And the ultimate outcome, of course, is the end of slavery with the 13th Amendment. But again, could that have happened some other way besides a terrible, terrible war in terms of property destruction, loss of life, a section ruined? But of course, you have to look at causation and in the Union mind, in the Northern mind, the Republican mind, what they're trying to do here. This is a recreation of the Union. And really, the recreation, what we often call Reconstruction, begins in 1861 and 62 when the Republicans start ramming their legislation through Congress. And we'll talk about that with Reconstruction. The South is going to be under the federal heel. There's Northern Reconstruction. There's Southern Reconstruction. A lot of things going on. And that'll be a lot of fun to talk about. So I'll see you for the next